One of the things I love most about your work is that it jolts me a little bit. You know, there's such energy in it. And your eye moves in such patterns when you're looking at your work. And so I always come away from it slightly awakened, you know, and it's as much the energy of the painting itself as it is the subject.
Yeah.
You know?
No, absolutely.
Is that what you think about? Because you're the act of painting these things is so energetic for you on your behalf.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Even if it's a small thing, I'm usually standing up and walking around it and pacing back and forth. I would say that to me, the barometer for a successful artwork is in its individual dynamism. And what I mean by that is that if you didn't know who made it and you didn't have a context for when it was made or where it was made, and you see this artwork out in space somewhere in the distant future, does the thing pop?
It pops.
And if it doesn't, then it's not any good. And so as a result, as I'm making each of these pieces, and I don't have a linear roadmap to follow. I'm kind of making it up as I go along. And so I'm constantly fixing mistakes isn't exactly right, but I'm because I wouldn't view any of the things that I'm making as mistakes, but I'm definitely fixing something as I go until I really feel like the piece has its own life. Because ultimately, people talk about their artworks as their children and they don't want to ever part with them. And I view it differently,
right,
which is that, yes, these things are my children, but I'm preparing them to go out into the world to lead their own lives.
And make a difference.
And make a difference.
That's
very
important to you.
Right? That's exactly right.
So talk a little bit about the Watering Hole Foundation and what you've done with that.
So the Watering Hole Foundation was a device that I created so that I could do good, is the short answer. I was sitting in a little mosquito nest tent with my then 7-year-old son in East Africa listening to elephants breathe at night, and knew that there was a terrible poaching crisis going on. And I had been traveling back and forth to East Africa since I was a teenager, and I felt like if I didn't do something about it, then who would? And if not me, and if not now, then when? And so I did the exercise of figuring out if I wanted to make some part of positive impact, how could I go about doing it? I don't have a ton of money, so I can't just send it to Washington and hope for the best. And I also have a life here in New Orleans that I love, so I can't just give everything up and go and shoot poachers. So where do you live in the middle of that? And the Watering Hole Foundation became a means for me to create art, sell the art through the foundation, and give the money away back to East Africa in this case, so that I could do some good, tactile good with what I was making. And then the nature of these things is funny, right? If you are trying to do something self-serving, it's usually hard to do. If you're trying to do something where your intent is generally for the better good, genuinely for the better good, then it gets easier. And people want to help you and participate. So as a result, the Watering Hole Foundation over the last several years now has grown so that I still make art, which I sell and give the money back to. But I also go around the country and I speak about man and his role in nature and balance and our lost balance and what the consequences of that might be. I do things with schools and kids. I do various programs where we reach out to raise awareness artistically and for the environment. And then at the end of the day, it's become and becoming a communal effort where we're all sort of trying to help each other figure out how to go up against these forces, which are so seemingly helplessly large that we all recognize. And inaction leads to demise. So this is just one of many calls to action to prevent the demise.
So how do you measure the success of an effort like that over time?
As long as you're still doing it, it's successful.
All right.
I mean that. I mean, because
yeah,
there's...
No, I know.
Because the target moves, right? So that's not, there is no single silver bullet to solve all of these issues. And the issues that we're talking about here in particular have to do with the endangered species crisis. You know, 40% of life on the planet and 25,000 species, something like that, endangered. And the cause being us. And so a lot of that has to do with the issues that face us as as a globe, as a civilization and a species on the globe. Now, that is not a single thing that can be done to fix. So as a result, how do you measure success? You measure success by still being in the ballgame.
And throwing whatever you have at the
and
problem.
And doing what you have and spreading the good word and insisting on other people's participation and not taking setbacks as anything other than what they are, which is a setback but not a final conclusion.
So I have to ask, what was it like for that 7-year-old to be under that mosquito net with you listening to the elephants?
He fussed at me. He said, "Dad, I'm sleeping."
Well,
I woke him up. I said, Landry, there's an elephant right there. You know, they breathe so you can feel it through your feet. And so I rustled, Landry, wake up. And he did. He rolled over. He said, "Dad, I'm sleeping."
Oh.
Now then, I brought him back again. He's now 11. And I brought him back again to East Africa this summer. And I also brought my 6-year-old daughter. And it happened again with my son. We were in another tent. Another herd of elephants came in at night, and they were all around us. And I tried to wake him up, and he just had nothing to do with it. Now, my daughter, on the other hand, was hugely enthusiastic.
All right. Of course.
And she's a spry little thing. So she's small enough that I could carry her on my shoulders, because most of what I do is not in cars. It's walking.
Mm-hmm.
So she's too little to walk 10 or 15 miles, but she's also little enough that I could carry her on my shoulders. And so we had a symbol where if she would tap me on the head, it meant that she saw something that I didn't, because she was up higher than me and she could see over ridges. And the intent was for her to tell me if she saw a buffalo or an elephant or something like that that I needed to pay attention to. But she got into it. So every time she saw a plant or a rock or a butterfly, yeah, I would get smacked on the head.
But how thrilling for
yeah,
you
it was wonderful
to see the world through her eyes.
No, it was divine. I mean, that's part of, look, by the way, that's part of why things like the Watering Hole Foundation are so important. Because it's not just that I feel a responsibility myself to do something, but rather that we all collectively have a responsibility to make sure that the experience that I have with my children, that I had with my parents, they can have with their children. And so all of this is all mixed together into culpability, responsibility, and action.
Well, one of the things I adore about you is that your life is so open and flows so it seems gracefully from one thing to another, from family to work to students. I know you have this open studio. You have classes come to your studio from time to time to watch you work, talk about these problems. This book is so gorgeous, but at the same time, you're not, as you say, a coffee table book kind of guy.
Yeah, much to my publisher's chagrin.
Oh, well, they'll adjust. But you do all these other wonderful things. I mean, you have stationery and note cards and puzzles, and the children's books are such, you know, successful, wonderful lessons as well as joyful reading experiences.
Yeah.
So it's all, it seems all of a piece for you.
I don't get too many critical reviews in traditional art magazines, that sort of thing. It's not really the way I do my life, right? But I had a review many years ago, which was a criticism where it described me as a whale swimming through the ocean with his mouth wide open, filtering everything that came in. And I always took that as a great compliment, that is in fact the way that I live my life, that my eyes are open. And I'm out experiencing as much as I possibly can and trying to share that in as many ways as I can. So whether that's in a book like A Brush with Nature, where you're talking about some rather heady stuff and, you know, and very visually, or in the Tales from the Watering Hole trilogy, where you're doing, you know, anthropomorphic parable-based stories, or in puzzles. And all the avenues that I go down, and needlepoint and everything else. I'm not a licensing magnate, right? I'm not very good at it. And I don't really seek it out. But I also don't condemn it or avoid it. So when people, part of the nature of being open to the world and to people is that people have good ideas. And if you're open to them, then things that you didn't expect can come your way. Now, there are some pitfalls involved in that, because you could think something sounds really great, not know enough about it, and then go way down a track and realize that, and I'll give you an example. So, as you mentioned, I have puzzles. And for a while, I was in the mass market puzzle business. So that means, you know, 100,000 puzzles off of a press in China. And they get distributed at Barnes & Noble and Borders and places like that when they still existed. And so that industry has a 1% attrition rate. So out of 100,000 puzzles, that means that 1,000 puzzles don't have enough pieces or too many pieces or the pieces aren't the right pieces for the box or all kinds of things, right? So now that doesn't sound so bad if it's 1 out of 100. But 1,000 puzzlers, hell hath no fury like. So I got real live hate mail for 4 or 5 things a week from people all over the world. I'd get these long written letters from someone in Singapore fussing about how there was too few pieces in the puzzle. And I completely empathized with them, right? Because the nature of all of these things that I engage with should be a satisfying engagement, not one which is frustrating. So now as a result, I'm a little more careful with the things that I make in that, for example, puzzles. I now only do wooden puzzles that are made by hand.
Right. Nice. So the finer things.
Yeah, well, correct. I mean, my audience as a result shrinks slightly from the general hoi polloi. At those, you know, at the price points that huge retailers want. But my interaction with my, with the people who collect my things is much heightened. Mm-hmm. And as a result, much more satisfying to them and to me.
Wow. Who'd have thought? Who'd have thought?
Not me until I started getting hate mail.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you about is at the end of this book, there's this wonderful essay by Nick Palmgarten of The New Yorker. I mean, what was it like for you? You all are old friends.
Yeah.
What was it like for you to kind of submit your life for his consideration, you know, or just... you know, what was it like for you to read that essay assessing you?
Reading the essay was nice because he wrote nice things about me. In the first place was embarrassing.
I loved it when he said, when he saw the most interesting man in the world ad campaign, he thought it was you. That is interesting, isn't it?
It's always funny how you look at your own life through your own eyes versus the way other people look at it. Perception is so much of reality. And it's a little bit like, you know, you have this experience every day, listening to your own voice in your head versus listening to your own voice on the radio, two very, very different things.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. So too is how others perceive, in this case, me versus how I perceive me. Right. So it's very nice for Nick Palmgarten to compare me to the most interesting man in the world, but I feel like I have no answers. And I'm constantly searching for even the right questions.
But at least you make the effort.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I'm not going to roll over and call it quits. I don't know how many cracks you get at this in life. This life, period. And then in life itself. And so, you know, I always played baseball. Into my 30s, in fact. Frankly, I still would if I could. And baseball games are very good analogies for how you live your life. The game continues on, but you only get 3 or 4 at-bats in it. And in the course of those 3 or 4 at-bats, if you perform, you are helping the whole team. Now, you're performing well, but in those moments when it's your time, it's not about you and how well your statistics go, but rather, will you win the game for the team based on the moment that you have? And life is like that.
Yes, it is.